This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Von Goldstein. Alex, great having you on.
It's a pleasure to be on, Robert. And I added the Von to my name to Germanicize myself because I'm only half Jewish and I feel much, much more European. So.
And yeah, Goldstein is kind of, it's sort of one of the most stereotypical like Jewish names.
Exactly, which is hilarious.
Especially considering like the politics you're affiliated with.
Yeah, I know. But I'm not an anti-Semite. So, that's one of my few positive qualities, I guess. If some people see that as positive, some will see that as negative.
How did you sort of get interested in the sort of dissident right political sphere? You would sort of describe yourself the last time as where radical centrism meets dissident right. Can you talk kind of briefly about political and ideological evolution?
Sure. Well, it's a bit strange, the process that I went through. But it started out sometime last year. I think I was going through periods of depression and romantic rejection, not unlike Nietzsche, and got to a point where I figured I really needed to figure out who I was so that I wouldn't be trapped within these throes of nihilism anymore. I began meditating a lot, and I took an interest in Buddhist ideas. I started reading Schopenhauer, and when I went into this way of thinking, I became a much more rational thinker than I was before. Before, I thought about things in a much more feelings-based way, in a much more emotionally-based way. Looking back at myself a year ago, I think I've grown as a person just in terms of my mental strength. And I think I was a weaker person then. But as I went on this process of just sort of thinking about my mind and how I perceived reality, I sort of accidentally red-pilled myself. So I took basically the first pill of the internet, which is the red pill. And I think I could just sum that up as a rejection of liberalism.
Different people have kind of their definition of red pill. Obviously,
sure,
that's a reference to the film The Matrix. But I guess people, the red pill just means what the truth is as opposed to what people are taught their whole lives kind of by society as a large. But different people have their
exactly
own sort of personal take on the red pill.
Exactly, and that's something that that I wanted to get into in describing this process, is that people must go through it individually, and ideally you would end up developing your own conclusions. It's not about being in some kind of echo chamber where you're forced to think a certain way. It's about developing your own worldview and your own perception of the truth. But for me, I think it's easiest to sum it up as a kind of rejection of liberalism, or how we perceive liberalism in contemporary society.
What is your definition of liberalism? That's kind of a loaded term, because there's sort of
sure
a mainstream definition of liberalism that you would get from like a Rush Limbaugh, and then you have someone like Alexander Dugin, who defines liberalism. He rejects liberalism, even classical liberalism, but he would define it as individualism and modernity. What's your personal take on that, and do you reject it?
Well, the way that I view this is that each step of this process is moving another layer of liberalism. So when one first starts thinking this way, the first things that they'll reject are sort of, I guess, what we call now like the SJW-type platitudes. The kind of crazy progressive liberalism is the first thing that gets rejected. And so I'm defining liberalism as a kind of mutable force with different layers that basically just means society, liberal society. And I guess the furthest point of this is what Dugin talks about, which is rejecting liberalism, rejecting classical liberalism, in favor of tradition. And what I think about it, well, I guess I have a kind of a dualistic approach to this, where I think that people often attribute the idea of liberalism, they think that liberalism and freedom are one and the same, but I think that individualistic freedom can exist within tradition. So I think I do see major faults even within the ideas of classical liberalism, but I'm not entirely opposed to those ideas.
I guess the way I look at it is, I wouldn't say it should be thrown out completely. Obviously, there's a lot of good ideas that came out of it, but I think the key concept of it is that it's sort of this constant change. So while there could be good things about it, you could also make the argument that it led to where we are now. And
yeah.
what a radical traditionalist would say, and I'm not necessarily, I wouldn't describe myself as like a radical traditionalist or doctrinaire traditionalist. I don't like completely 100% reject everything about modernity, but they do have a point in wanting to kind of create something that's more permanent as opposed to this seeing like this constant change.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think what happens is that if a society slowly begins to accept more liberal ideas, inevitably the power that keeps these rules together, that keeps these rules in force, it becomes rules, like liberal rules, the rules of liberalism, total control. That's what happens. The state is able to have total control over everyone, whereas in tradition, you are essentially controlled by tradition, by what's in your mind. So you have freedom within that. So basically, I mean, like Hans Hermann Hoppe, he also rejects classical liberalism, and part of this is him saying that the rules or norms of a society are meant to create cohesion, not disruption. And in our current, you know, American society, the rules of liberalism seem to only create disruption.
The thing about it is, in American history, is we had individualism, but we also had, people had it wasn't a pure form of individualism. Conservatives are always complaining about collectivism, but people had sort of this sense of group identity. They were part of a group. What happens with radical individualism is you get people who are just totally atomized, and then they sort of lose their completely, they're not really free, and because they're sort of basically easily controlled by these greater institutions.
Yes, and with this, they feel they have to stay within the tribe of liberalism. And I think something that comes out of almost rejecting classical liberalism is just completely removing yourself from the tribe of liberals and becoming essentially a real individual, someone who does not care what the others around them think, because they have purpose and that they follow tradition. So that's where the thing is, I think people think if you reject classical liberalism, you become ruthless, you have no sense of morality or something, because liberalism is the religion of our society. But I think that one can reject classical liberalism and find the morality somewhere else. Maybe the best thing about classical liberalism is just private property, really, because your own body is your private property.
So you're starting up a podcast. You're going to call it The Lord of the Gadflies. Is that up yet, or you haven't started that?
Well, I've been trying to do it a bit, and it really hasn't gone where I've wanted it to. So I think within the next few weeks, I'll start pushing it where I want it to and doing some interviews with some people, and then hopefully it will be up. But I haven't really started it.
What would you like to sort of accomplish, and what do you think the overall theme will be?
Well, what I want to accomplish is essentially, I mean, I think that our world right now is in a point of disintegration, that we're entering into, you know, the Hindu idea of like the Kali Yuga, or maybe we've been there since industrialization. Our world is disintegrating. We're losing tradition. We're losing culture, and we're losing individuality, real individuality, a sense of self, a sense of purpose. People lack this, and people are moving into a void. I just saw a cover of like Variety magazine, and it's about, you know, there's like these Oculus Rifts and all these you know, these drawings of these people, these business people on the cover, and they're you know, it's like Welcome to the Void or something like that, and I can just see people I know accepting this void and putting on the virtual reality mask and just going into some fake digital world. And I want people to reject this, and I want people to embrace the truth and embrace reality. So that's really my goal, to just try to get people to come on to this way of the side of thinking. I don't really have an interest in participating in the echo chamber, and I think there are people who are a lot more intelligent than I am, a lot more well-spoken than I am, and people who have much more experience in dealing with these topics than I do. And that's why I'm not so interested in dealing with the echo chamber. I'm more interested in just bringing people on to these ideas, getting people away from the losing every sense of individuality, every sense of self that they have.
Who are some of the guests that you look forward to interviewing?
Ah, geez. I mean, I haven't thought about it too much. There are some people that I would like to talk to. I mean, if I could somehow be able to speak to Alexander Dugin, that would be, a great conversation, just because I'm fascinated by his ideas. I would also like to speak to John Derbyshire, because, I'm very interested in the neoconservative movement and its death. I believe, you know, it's essentially going through its death right now, so I think I'd like to talk to Derbyshire about that, if I could get a hold of him. And I'm interested also in the YouTuber The Truth Will Live. You've had her on a few times on your show. And I think in a lot of ways she is similar to me, in that I think we're around the same age, and she also kind of existed in that kind of hipster Brahmin class and has, you know, become a traditionalist as well. So... I guess more of like a radical centrist kind of traditionalist.
How would you describe the kind of culture you were brought up in? You mentioned you were brought up from a sort of a Brahmin background, not like your stereotypical like kind of right winger.
No. Yeah, I'm from North New Jersey. I live in a fairly normal suburban town. I went to public school. And I've always been interested in niche things, whether it was, you know, experimental music or, you know, Lars von Trier movies or, Pier Paolo Pasolini, things like that. I've always just kind of like rejected mainstream culture and looked for solace in film and art. I was always interested in music. I played music for a long time. I haven't played really for a while, recently. But that was the sort of the world I existed in. It was kind of, this kind of music, movies, fashion, sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of thing. And I saw the music world around me slowly become very I can't think of another word other than a posed up, which is, internet colloquialism. But, yeah, I mean, things just became very, very much, I don't like usually like to use the word, but very just SJW-ish, very Tumblr-ish. And it was just very unappealing. It's just, I felt like it wasn't for me. And I can, for about a year and a half, felt like I existed in this world that I was being rejected from, that I didn't have a place in. And last year I just decided to completely unplug myself and go somewhere nuts.
So you're from Jersey? I've never been there, but I know like in movies and TV shows it's always kind of like the butt of jokes. How accurate are the stereotypes of Jersey?
Well, I'm from more of a very suburban type setting. It's not so much a kind of Sopranos, Guido-y kind of New Jersey. It's more of a really stereotypical, just suburban town. some people around me in neighboring towns sort of have that spirit about them, but I wouldn't say it's so accurate. Because in a way, I think that, you know, globalism and modernity have just made everyone the same, no matter where you are, especially in America. I mean, I meet people from different places, and everyone sort of has like a similar personality. Everyone's watching the same movies. They're plugged into the same Facebook feeds. The media pushes forward the same opinions on nearly everything. So I wouldn't say those ideas are so accurate, but some people are kind of like that.
People talk about different regional identities and how the country is kind of homogenizing. So it's not – people talk about diversity, but there's not a sense of genuine diversity.
No, certainly not a genuine diversity.
On this kind of topic, I remember in the debate, Ted Cruz accused kind of Donald Trump of having like New York values and how New York values are not the values of the rest of the country.
Yes, yes. But I don't think Ted is completely accurate there. I think that the New York values that he's referring to are just liberal values, which, you know.
I think in some ways they're doing the opposite, because where Trump's coming from is, he's from New York, so he has New York values. And you're the product of where you're from, whether you like to admit it or not. And I think where Trump is coming from is he is searching for where – he's trying to find where the American people are and trying to find where they stand and create his – message based on that. Ironically, Ted Cruz is kind of the opposite, because Ted Cruz is this evangelical from Texas, but he's getting all this money from basically Goldman Sachs. So in a sense,
yes, exactly.
they're kind of doing the opposite.
Yes, completely. I mean, if anything, Ted Cruz is really the one who embodies those real, like, the New York values, if he means, you know, international banking. I think that Cruz and you know, Rand Paul and these other, you know, guys on stage up there, they just represent, you know, the state, the establishment, the conservative ink that runs that wing of the government. And, you know, then you have, you know, the Hillary Clintons or even the Sanders up there that, you know, are government employees and represent that kind of neoliberalism. And I think what Trump represents is just, you know, really the American people. He represents normal people. He isn't really – I mean, people will say he's not presidential. He doesn't have – you know, they'll call him dumb because of the way that he speaks in a stream of consciousness way. But I think he really is not a politician. He isn't really presidential. He's just essentially a man who is – fighting against globalism. Whether he knows it or not, he sees that these forces are gathering a total control and is fighting against it.
With Trump, I was kind of very skeptical of him at first, but the more research I've done, he's actually made comments a while back, like in the late 1980s, he put out a newspaper ad criticizing a lot of the trade deals. At the time, it was with Japan. And he did an interview with Larry King back in the 90s denouncing Clinton's war in Kosovo. So my take on him is I don't think – some people think he's a total charlatan, or he's like being put in there as like a Manchurian candidate. My take on him is I think he genuinely cares about these issues. But at the same time, he's saying like, look, I'm a businessman. If I want to make it, if you want to be a billionaire, you sort of have to play the game in politics. And some people have called him like a hypocrite for his stance, because like he's employed H-1B visa holders in the past.
Sure.
He's
donated
money
to the on that too. Yeah.
But he's at least upfront about it. I have more respect for that than I do for someone like Ted Cruz, who he flip-flops and then tries to weasel his way out of it.
Exactly. I mean, Ted Cruz plays the role of the politician, where I think Trump really just is a man as an individual who I mean, maybe, I mean, my ideas throughout my life have changed. I mean, I would love to be the kind of person who is just one way all the time and pushes that forward. But we all change. And I think Trump really just, he's a man who is on a mission to do something. And, you know, not everything he's going to say is going to be perfect because he doesn't have experience doing this kind of stuff. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I could accuse myself of like, fawning over Trump, but I think there is an element of reality within him that really hasn't, you know, been in the public eye for a very long time.
Are there any issues where you strongly disagree with Donald Trump on?
Well, I mean, it's a strange thing because. I mean, his love of eminent domain, I'm not interested in. And, I mean, I could go through the list with Trump and find a million things I'm uninterested in. I mean, his love of the NSA, I'm not interested in, you know, the NSA.
Oh, yeah, I remember I interviewed Keith Preston on Trump.
Yeah,
I think the conclusion, his biggest flaw is his support, like, for the surveillance state.
Sure. And Preston makes a pretty good argument about Trump, and I think he thinks that Sanders is probably a better choice because Sanders says he's against the NSA. But the thing for me is that Trump is not an issues guy. It's not about issues. It's not really about anything other than ideology and what he represents as a force and what he's up against. I mean, I view it on purely metaphorical terms. Because, I mean, we see this with politicians all the time. They say one thing, they get in office, they just do what everyone else before them did. So, for me right now, I think I view Trump as a much more of a metaphorical figure, as a symbolic figure.
Will you describe yourself as a radical centrist where the radical center meets the dissident right? And I've
discussed
this concept a lot on my show. So, basically, this is sort of how politics work. You have the establishment, and then the establishment has some areas where they overlap with liberals and some areas where they have overlap with conservatives. So basically, to summarize radical centrism, is it means sort of combining the best ideas of the left and the right, but opposing the corrupt establishment.
Sure, definitely. And, you know, while I'll say, you know, I get in these mental spaces where I think, like, you know, about rejecting classical liberalism, I do describe myself in many ways as a traditionalist. I think there are many ideas that are kind of attached to liberalism in the mainstream, ideas that I don't think are necessarily liberal. Like protecting the environment. Of course we should protect the environment. Protecting endangered species and animals. Of course we should not, you know, eliminate every buffalo, every rhino. I mean, we should preserve our planet.
That's also the other flaw of Trump is when people ask him about environmental issues, he's been very dismissive about that. But the thing is, you're not going to find someone who's right on every issue.
Sure. And I mean, you know, if you look at Barack Obama in 2008, I remember listening to a speech where he said, you know, when I'm inaugurated, you'll remember this year as the year where global warming stopped or something. I mean, it's a lot of the environmental concerns that we see now, I feel, you know, they're reflected in a kind of state propaganda, you know, how scientism has replaced religion. So, I mean, our conceptions of environmentalism, I think, are at a really odd point right now because of the influence of, like, government in these ideas, if you get what I mean there.
What do you see as, like, the most crucial environmental issues that we're facing?
Well, it's a strange thing. I mean, you know, people talk to me about global warming, and I've had, I mean, I think this is almost pretty comical because when I was in college, I had a professor, someone who studied geology, and he, you know, said if you look at these ice crystals, you can see that carbon monoxide has risen after the temperature has gone up. So, you know, the Earth just goes through this process of cooling and warming. So I don't really know how I feel about global warming, But I do think that we need to get off oil. I think we need to go to other places. I mean, even just for geopolitical purposes, we need to get off oil. So, I mean, I think getting off oil, moving to better, cleaner energies is a good idea. And that's something I'm interested in. And I'm also interested in protecting the natural world, idea and sense of totality, just protecting the world. Because, you know, as globalization continues, the world will just become a parking lot in 200 years.
And that also ties in with aesthetics. You go to a lot of
sure.
places and you see nothing but ugly track homes and strip malls.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, just the world losing any sense of aesthetics, like you said. And I mean, and the natural world itself, the environment, is part of that. I mean, like a strip mall, Walmart, that's part of nature, as you know, because it exists in the world. The same thing with a lake and a meadow. But the lake and the meadow should be protected. It should be preserved. The whole world should not become that Walmart parking lot. You know, it is a real thing. It is part of nature, but it has no aesthetic value, and the world should have a sense of beauty to it. I think that's so important.
What is sort of the relationship with radical centrism and also the dissident right, which you affiliate with? Obviously,
sure.
They're both of anti-establishment, but obviously there are some areas where they're going to diverge from each other as well.
Yes. I mean, I think that there are some people who believe that everything in the world boils down to race. And I think that these people are, they come from a place of just complete, like, neo-reaction, just totally, you know, like, just rejecting modern ideas about multiculturalism. And I don't believe that multiculturalism really works in a pure sense. I don't, but I also think that, you know, civilization is important. Like, you know, a European man can move to Japan and then maybe he could never really be Japanese, but he could admire the culture and try to become one with it. And many people do this. So I find it a bit distasteful when people will completely judge someone based on their race, because, you know, just because someone has English DNA doesn't mean that they'll have any advantage over someone who has Russian DNA versus Mongolian. I mean, maybe they'll, you know, there's, you know, human biodiversity and all these things, but we are individual people. So, you know, I don't think that we can jump to race with every single issue. So that's where I kind of diverge myself from the dissident right. And also, I mean, though race is definitely important, but and also just in terms of women's issues, I'm not completely I don't think that all women should stay in the home and just be homemakers and not have the rights of men. I think that, you know, for many women that might be a better idea, but you know, history has shown there's been many women who have, you know, excelled to great heights. So, I guess one could call those kind of liberal ideas, but I don't reject those.
The other thing is the radical center is more of a big tent movement, while I guess like the dissident right or the alternative right is more of a niche.
Yes, exactly. And I don't really have an interest in being part of an echo chamber where there are these rules that I don't feel are completely moral. So
I guess a good example of that, there's a website that you're familiar with called uns.com, and it doesn't really have a clear, like, ideological agenda, but it kind of provides a platform for basically anyone who is outside the establishment. There's even a few anti-establishment leftists who write for that site.
Yes, exactly. And I think if you're familiar with tackymac.com, that's another good one. You know, people like Jim Goad or even, you know, Gavin McInnes. A lot of people don't like Gavin, but I think he's pretty funny. You know, these people, I exist in a liberal world. I exist in modernity. Even though I oppose it, I still exist within it. So for me to completely just oppose this, I mean, I do oppose it in me, but I can't ride the tiger every single minute of my life. I have to exist in this world, and I don't want to reject people for being something. You know, so that's where I think, yeah, it's much better to stay within this place where you're just looking at statistics and talking about ideas and just moving away from the establishment.
Someone like Steve Saylor, who writes there, he's effective because he doesn't have a explicit ideology. He just gives people the information and lets them conclude their own ideas from that. I think that's a lot
yes.
more effective than saying this is my ideology, and you have to and really shoving your ideology down someone's throat.
Yes, I don't, and that's why even when I'm talking about the way I think, I still want to reiterate that people must go through this process on an individual level, and I don't really have an interest in forcing the way I think on anyone. I want people to open their minds. I want people to move away from the establishment thinking. But I don't feel they have to get to where I am and become, you know, somewhat of this kind of radical centrist traditionalist type. I don't think it's important to do this, for everyone to do this.
How would you describe your economic outlook?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm interested in Hans Hermann Hoppe and Murray Rothbard. I'm interested in anarchy. I'm interested in capitalism, but I also feel like there are major flaws within capitalism. So I don't have a fully fledged economic philosophy, though I am very interested in capitalism. This is more in a growing phase.
So you're saying your economic views haven't fully evolved. What do you see as the biggest flaw of capitalism?
Well, the biggest flaw of capitalism is that, I would say that capitalism, it can diverge itself from tradition, and it can diverge itself from reality, and you know, like how the government essentially exists within capitalism, and you know, one could view it as a corporation, and you know, it pushes forward ideas, it pushes forward an agenda. In the same way that someone like Jeff Bezos, who I believe he's the CEO of Amazon, he bought the Washington Post. Actually, Trump brought this up, which I thought was interesting. And, you know, and Carlos Slim, who bought the New York Times, they both have their own agendas. So they own these magazines that push forward, these newspapers that push forward their agendas. So if there was a pure capitalism, perhaps, you know, the world could move away from the truth, could move away from tradition, because, you know, there could be huge monopolies on industries that push forward propaganda. But, you know, but the thing is, the government at the same time is almost another corporation, and it has its agenda. So the idea that the state has legitimacy, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. I'm at a weird point with this, because we believe the state to be legitimate, but I don't really know if it is.
And that's the thing with the state is corrupt, but if people talk about abolishing the state, I mean, what replaces it?
Exactly, yes. Well, Hermann Hoppe says that it can the only that democracy will eventually fail, and the state can only exist as a monarchy. So it's essentially just monarchy or a free society.
What happens, I think, if you dramatically reduce the size of government, then, let's say, corporations could come in and privatize everything, and then they could take a monopoly on all the natural resources, the wealth, infrastructure, and then institute their own sort of like private police force, and the corporations would sort of fill in that void if you were to abolish the government. So, well, the government's corrupt. There has to be like some level of checks and balances.
Yes, exactly, and that's kind of the ideological point that I'm at with these ideas. I'm not really sure where I'm going to go with this, but I need to do a lot more reading. But that's the yellow pill, the anarcho-capitalism rejection of the state.
So you touched on these different pills. So let's see, yellow pill you mentioned is like anarcho-capitalism rejection of the state. Red pill is kind of it just kind of can be a euphemism for the truth, for just like
exactly,
the truth.
Exactly, yeah. That's
but
fine,
I think
yeah.
Red pill is most commonly used by a lot of neo-reactionary types, and also like the game types as well.
Sure.
And then you said from the red pill, there's the iron pill, then there's also the black pill, which you could make the case are offshoots of the red pill. And then there's the bread pill, which is... The bread pill is Christianity, but within
mm-hmm.
Christianity, there's so many forms of Christianity. There's
sure.
There's Christianity in its pure form, like the teachings of Christ. There is kind of modern sort of liberal Christianity.
Sure.
There's the Christianity that existed in Europe hundreds of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, I guess start off, like, how would you define the red pill?
Well, we talked about it before as a rejection of liberalism, I mean, which I guess is how I took it, where I say I took the red pill accidentally. I became interested in Schopenhauer, in Nietzsche. I became interested in Buddhism. So I saw myself as an Undermensch and wanted to become an Übermensch. And, you know, the red pill was basically, I realized I was taking it accidentally. People say that the red pill is also understanding truths about gender, about race, about accepting nationalism over globalism. So it basically is, you know, what, I guess what you could call the truth, you know, and it leads people in different directions. I mean, you might end up becoming a devotee of Kevin MacDonald or reading American Renaissance, or you might become a pickup artist. I mean, there's a lot of different places one can go from here. Or you could just, you know, stay within what you know, but feel you need to grasp the truth. I mean, there's many different options within the red pill, but I gather that the only two ways out of the red pill, because taking the red pill isn't really a great thing for oneself. It in many ways it can be very ostracizing. You feel like you're different from those around you. So you can essentially, from this point forward, you have to take another pill. And I think that the two pills that really follow the red pill are the black pill. It's either the black pill or the iron pill.
Well, the iron pill is, I haven't heard of the iron pill until you told me about it, but it basically means people who try to improve themselves. But the black pill is people who enter the red pill, but they become more depressed, alienated, nihilistic.
Yes,
and
exactly.
There was that article that Colin Liddell wrote about the black pill a while back.
Yes, I read Colin's article, and he posted a video, and I mean the whole article seemed to center around that kid Toby Reynolds, who has a YouTube video, a YouTube channel called First Last. And if you watch Reynolds' videos, he basically just walks around and says he's upset. He doesn't have a girl in his life. And he basically represents, you know, the red-pilled person who is kind of still holding on to that liberalism, still holding on to that feeling of meeting others to make them feel better, to be accepted by those around them. He's not going basically the iron pill route of, you know, riding the tiger in the Julius Evola sense or reading Roman literature or reading Greek literature. And actually, I have this Marcus Aurelius Meditations in front of me. I mean, I wanted to tell you this. There's this, you know, he's basically just all these little aphorisms he's written, but he wrote this one part where he's like, claim your entitlement to these epithets, good, decent, truthful, in mind clear, cooperative, and independent. And if you keep yourself to these titles, not just a grubbing for this acclamation from others, you will be a new man and enter a new life. To continue the same as you have been up to now, to be torn apart and defiled in the life you live, is just as senseless is just senseless self-preservation, like that of half-eaten gladiators who, mauled all over and covered in blood by wild beasts, still plead to be kept alive for the next day when in their same state they will meet again the same claws and teeth. So I think Aurelius, you know, writing thousands of years ago, essentially is explaining the difference between the black pill and the iron pill.
What is sort of the best, so that the best example of like the extreme black pill, I guess it would be, but obviously the most perfect example of that would be a lot of these mass shooters.
Completely. I'd say Elliot Rodger is the personification of the black pill. And also, yeah, you know, the kind of nihilistic modernity.
And I guess he sort of writes a lot about, in his manifesto, like the sort of themes of sort of the emptiness of modernity.
Yes, and there's one part in his book where he's very upset that there's this young black man who he's hanging out with who says he lost his virginity to a blonde white girl. And he's very upset about this because he says, oh, I'm descended from aristocracy and he's descended from slaves. This is so unfair. And I think that's essentially taking the kind of, you know, totally taking the black pill, not realizing that one has to better themselves in their life. This thinking like, oh, I'm descended from this. I come from this culture. I come from these great European heights. I come from this, so I deserve this. Not that I have to better myself in my life. I have to take better care of myself. I need to treat others better. Not things like that. It's essentially just this blanket nihilistic entitlement. And I think that you see that in a lot of people online. You see that because that's what these people are doing. They're just in echo chambers on the internet, and they're entitled.
For people to get to the iron pill, they need to be surrounded by other people who share their values. If someone is surrounded by people they feel disconnected to, then it becomes very easy to slip into that black pill.
I think it's hard either way. I think you know, if you take this red pill and you are rejected by everyone around you, I mean, there's plenty of cases throughout our history where people have been rejected and come up to greatness. I mean, sometimes cutting yourself off from those around you can lead you to a place of true individuality, to truth.
But it takes a lot of personal strength. And
exactly. Yes, but I think that people can obtain these levels of higher consciousness and build their own strengths, develop their amygdala, per se.
And I guess then there's the blue pill, which is just like the conformist masses.
Yes, I mean, I guess everyone is blue-pilled, and I think, you know, the blue pill is just this liberalism that runs through our society. Most people are blue-pilled. And then I guess you could be purple-pilled as well, which is I guess that's the red pill that doesn't really lead to the iron pill or to the black pill. It's just you take the red pill, you know these things, but you live within a blue reality.
You're also interested in talking about sort of millennial issues. Obviously, you're a millennial.
Sure.
And one thing is one of the issues is in politics, like there's a strong millennial support for Bernie Sanders.
Sure, yes. And, yeah. I mean, well, what is your opinion of Bernie Sanders and the millennials? What do you think about it?
I think what is unique about them is, on one hand, they grew up with a lot of prosperity. In some regards, they were spoiled, but then now they're facing one of the worst economic declines in history since the Great Depression. So I think they're reacting to that, and I think that's really what's unique about them.
Yes, I mean, the young Bernie Sanders supporters, they do not like Hillary Clinton. And most of them, I think, will not vote for Hillary Clinton. These people, they know that there's something wrong with the world. They know that there's something wrong. They look out on the street and they see what's happening. They watch the news. They see what's happening, and they know there's something wrong. But I think that these people, they lack the will to really jump off into the truth itself. They still believe in the kind of liberal group cohesion, and they don't want to separate themselves from it. They don't want to go into these kind of dangerous ways of thinking, into these challenging ways of thinking. So they stay within the liberal tribe, and Bernie Sanders represents essentially that, the head of the liberal tribe that's against neoliberalism. But you know, I guess you can call them the cultural Marxists.
If you were to compare sort of Trump supporters versus Sanders supporters, I think where they're similar and where they're different is, I think the key difference is culturally. Sanders supporters are very liberal culturally. Well, with Trump supporters, there's an element of kind of cultural and racial anxiety about cultural and ethnic dispossession. There is an element of that Trump supporters.
Certainly.
And I think where the other thing that's different is Trump supporters tend to be from sort of the more, some Trump supporters are maybe, there might be some who are more upper middle class, but they tend to be more from the sort of traditional white working class background. His strongest support is in places like the Appalachias and throughout the South. A lot of Bernie Sanders supporters are people from, maybe they went to a good college, they had upper middle class parents, but they don't have the same economic opportunities. They're in massive debt. But I think what they have in common is they're both predominantly white, and they're both kind of responding to economic dispossession.
Exactly.
So that is the core issue they do have in common.
Mm-hmm. I think what's happening between this rift in the sort of the Trump people and the Bernie people, it's just sort of a rift within European Americans, those who have a sense of racial consciousness and with this a fear of disposition, and those who on the Bernie side more than likely lack that racial consciousness, or they feel ashamed about it and hide it. But you'll notice that the Bernie people more than likely live in, like, what Kevin McDonald refers to as implicit whiteness.
There was some issue where Bernie Sanders, for his campaign commercial, he used a video where he did the Simon and Garfunkel song America, and he showed a lot of, like, white people on farms. And the Clinton campaign actually kind of bashed him for not having enough diversity in that.
Yes, I mean, Hillary Clinton seems to only pander to minorities and women. Disaffected single women and minorities is who Hillary Clinton essentially panders to. And then you have Sanders, who is pandering to the bourgeois white, the upper-class whites, and, you know, I'm sure there's some good amount of non-whites in that group as well. And then you have you know, the kind of neocons, and I don't even know who they're pandering to, maybe Zionists. And then you have Trump, which is basically the white working class, and also I'm sure plenty of other people. Like, I know he has a pretty strong African American support as well.
I think even Mike Tyson endorses him.
Sure, yes, and I think that you know, within like a, you know, like black racial thought, you have the whole dual consciousness thing, like W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, which is like a, you know, is it like integration and intellectualism on the Du Bois side, or is it strength and, you know, tradition on the Booker T. Washington side? And I think Trump, from a black perspective, probably, I mean, I can only guess, but he probably represents this Booker T. Washington way of viewing the world. And I think a lot of black people who do not like the Black Lives Matter movement, who reject these ideas, they probably really like Donald Trump.
I think it's part of that. It could, a lot of it's economic, because they've been devastated by a lot of these manufacturing jobs going overseas.
Yes, and they also feel competition with they feel a sense of competition with illegal immigrants as well. Is it like that in California, Robert? I mean, I hear that in order to work at a McDonald's, you need to speak Spanish.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
But it seems that, I mean, a lot of people put pressure on, you know, candidates to pander to minorities when really it is, you know, whites are still at, I think, what, 62% of the population. So I think Trump and essentially, you know, seeing America through a set, I guess I wouldn't say Trump has a clear, you know, kind of white racial consciousness. He probably has an implicit whiteness about him, but he basically speaks to the needs of white people, and I think him doing that is why has shot up campaign.
Every now and then he makes some comment that's sort of almost sort of borderline. I remember he gave a speech at CPAC, and he was saying, like, oh, I have a lot of friends in Europe who would like to immigrate here, but they can't come here. Like, so he sort of, sometimes he says stuff like that, like, wink, wink.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's strange. I heard from Scott Adams, the Dilbert creator, that Trump is essentially whatever you want him to be. So, you know, for me, I mean, I'm certainly a nationalist. I'm not a white nationalist in that I would like America to remain, you know, Jared Taylor would say, a majority white. But I don't believe we should kick people out on basis of their race. No. But I would like the United States to remain a majority European country, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And the fact that when I say things like that, I need to shudder and look around me makes me think that there's something strange going on. And, you know, I was talking to Peter Brimelow one time on Facebook, and he told me that, you know, you have to be careful with what you say because we essentially live in an occupied country. And I think that it might be a little hyperbolic, but there is some truth to that.
So we were touching on the millennial issues.
Some
of the biggest cultural changes of millennials?
Yeah, well, I think what's happening with millennials is there is a divergence. It's been growing over the last few years. It started with Gamergate, where, you know, the kind of the pause was growing in our society, almost like, you know, some kind of Ghostbusters ghost or something. And the pause, like, or the blob, you know, it taken over film and seeped its way through music and taking over all forms of media. And as soon as the pause began to grow in video games, the kind of, you know, the neats, the not in education, employment, or training, these neat guys that live in their mom's basement. I mean, stereotypically, I'm sure plenty of these guys are great go-getter guys, but they really rejected it. And I think they had every right to, and they called out these people who were ruining their hobby. And, you know, it was a controversial thing, but out of that came a lot of people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who was able to appeal to people who are outside of the kind of gamer sphere and more of like the hipster type.
I think with the whole sort of innate phenomenon and those types who were involved with Gamergate is they were kind of probably thinking to themselves, like, look, we're at the bottom of society. Why are we being lectured about, like, privilege and discrimination and all that? We're at the very bottom.
Yes, no, I think that's completely true. And I have a lot of sympathy for these guys. I mean, are you familiar with Jim Goad's book, The Redneck Manifesto?
I haven't read it, but I've interviewed him a while back. I'm familiar with his
book. I'm a big fan of Jim's. But, you know, in The Redneck Manifesto, he essentially says, you know, these people that you call rednecks have been, you know, abused for essentially thousands of years, and we're allowed to bash these people. And I think the same goes for who we refer to as the neets. I mean, if you are...
Well, the neets
it's basically,
are like the new proletariat, because a lot of them are from middle-class backgrounds. They're not from the traditional...
Yes.
They're not
exactly.
Rednecks.
And it is... I mean, it's always going to be a white thing. It's always going to be the lower class whites that you're allowed to, that everyone's allowed to spit upon, because apparently they themselves are still privileged.
Would you say the neets are a mostly white phenomenon? I know in Japan you have the same thing. It's called hikikomori.
Yes, hikikomori. And, yeah, I mean, it's essentially the Japanification of America. Now, you know, I live in a kind of pluralistic, multicultural society in North New Jersey. And, I mean, there's plenty of, you know, the kind of black kids who love Digimon and Yu-Gi-Oh! And computer programming and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they exist. I know them. And I think that's a funny thing where when I see a lot of people online just sort of spouting all these racial epithets, I can't get behind this, because I know plenty of people of plenty different, you know, ethnic backgrounds that are, you know, fine, decent American people. So, I mean, race is a biological reality, but, you know, it doesn't define every aspect of life.
We're getting towards the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to touch upon that I didn't bring up?
Well, I would like to talk about the bread pill.
And that's Christianity.
Which is Christianity, yes. And I think that this is essentially like a final place within my thinking in essentially rediscovering Christianity. And
but as I said before, within Christianity, obviously, well, obviously, I don't think there's a black pill in Christianity, but there's definitely a blue pill, a red pill. There's different,
Definitely. A kind of, you know, Joel Osteen type Christianity, and, you know, these kind of mega church, this really terrible, tacky version of Christianity. And I think that people that are my age, we've kind of grown up with the 700 Club and the Westboro Baptist Church, and that's how we see Christianity, which I think is pretty disgusting. And what happened for me is, you know, when I was going through this process, I had essentially become an atheist because I was thinking in this super rational way that,
were
you know,
raised as Catholic, or were you brought up totally secular?
Well, my father is Jewish. My mother is Catholic. But I was raised in what I would call a culturally Catholic environment. We would do, I guess you could call it, Catholic things. You know, my grandfather was a very serious, you know, Anglo-Irish, you know, Scots-Irish Catholic man. And, you know, this had a massive, massive influence on me. I mean, my morality is a kind of a Catholic morality. But you know, I lived within modernity. I wasn't going to church all the time. I wasn't a serious Catholic. But when I went through this process and essentially became atheistic, I realized that looking at the world in that really kind of cold, rational, scientific way, one doesn't really have there's nothing that pushes you forward through life. There needs to be some kind of higher meaning. And I, you know, started reading Catholic literature, and you know, I saw God as being, as Thomas Aquinas says, that God, you know, it was an ipsum esse, like God is. And I saw God as being truth, as being love, as being mercy. And, you know, when you supplant yourself into these ideas, into these kind of red pill ideas, you can become very cold and cynical. I mean, or you know, these people that embrace these Hitlerisms and only fend for their own and this, you know, intense tribalism. And look, people can do whatever they want. But I think a love of humanity and a universal morality is important. And I think that, you know, you can find this within Christianity.
Where do you kind of see yourself going towards in the future? What are some of, like, your life goals that tie in also with what we were talking about, including religion?
Sure. I mean, I believe that we are moving further into the Kali Yuga, into disintegration, like I've said before, into a kind of total state control, a total pausing. I mean, I'm saying this in totally metaphorical terms, but just we're heading towards, I think, like, with, you know, like Oswald Spengler, like you would call it, like a pseudomorphosis, where we try to move forward into something else by rejecting tradition, and it just falls apart. And we're headed into this. And my life goals are just to better myself, to learn more, and to do whatever I can to move the world away from disintegration and to get others on this path as well. However they get here and wherever they go with it, just a rejection of modernity in the way it is perceived now.
As far as modernity goes, do you think it's a mistake of a radical traditionalist who want to create a clone of the past? Do you think we have to kind of look to create something anew from scratch?
Well, something new must be created. I mean, in a way, I kind of like some of the views of Guillaume Fah of archaeofuturism. Reading Schopenhauer, it allowed me to think that the world has always been the way it is now. You know, it's just people have changed slightly, but it's really the technology that has changed, the politics that have changed. The human beings are essentially the same. We haven't evolved as much as we think we have. So I think that by just embracing the truth, and this is why maybe I could call myself more of a radical centrist, because I don't have an explicit agenda other than just embracing the truth. And with this tradition, because I believe tradition is the truth, because the truth has been passed down from generation to generation. It is tradition. If we embrace this, then our society will naturally go to a golden age. It will go to where it should go. It will not go to disintegration. And what this golden age is, people need to figure out for themselves. And what people can go about this in a monoracial way, they can go about it in a multicultural way, in a multiracial way, in whatever way they feel they need to go about this. They need to develop their own tribes, their own newer ways of thinking. They need to do this, or else we will disintegrate and we will just be robots plugged into the literal matrix.
We are out of time. Alex von Goldstein, thanks for being on.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.